drawing near. Brother, sisters, please. Welcome to Bending the Arc, a show sponsored by the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, and it's dedicated to being in conversation with people working for equal justice in our region. And today I'm speaking with Lauren Kennedy, someone that I know and have worked with. Lauren is involved in many community efforts, and I know her, first met her as a consultant in the affordable housing space. And she's here to talk about that as an equal justice issue, and also to talk about her experience having a family member who is incarcerated and what that walk looks like, some of the resources available for it, and how we might support others who are in that situation. Lauren, I'll turn it over to you to explain a little bit about what you're involved in.
Thanks, Sharon. I really appreciate getting to have conversations about justice in general and about incarceration specifically. Touches a lot of people's lives, and there's still a lot of stigma around it. I grew up in California. I'm from California, grew up in San Jose, graduated high school in the year 2000, and I think have been very impacted by the cycles of incarceration and the cycles of economic boom and bust here. And I work in housing now, in part because personally and professionally in all my circles and spheres, I spent my younger years watching everybody's work and lives affected dramatically by housing or the lack of it. So now I work as, I work in a whole range of housing. I work as a core volunteer for emergency shelter, low barrier shelter efforts. I work in real estate as a realtor and do residential real estate. I also teach community purchase courses. Right now we have a work group for community property purchases. That's actually what got me into real estate. And then I work in affordable housing. I work as the executive director of the North Valley Housing Trust, a revolving loan fund for the construction of new affordable housing. And I currently am contracted with Home and Heart, a wonderful home sharing organization in our region. And I'm specifically helping them to develop a model for home sharing as an emergency measure for disaster recovery.
And can you tell our listeners a little bit more about community property purchasing?
Yeah. Community property purchasing is where you are buying some kind of property with one or more people that you're not related to. It's not the status quo of how financing and homes are set up and built. And at least in my lifetime, in my circles, I know so many people who are really drawn to the idea of living in a place that they share with friends or family, or just community members who have similar interests and values when it comes to the home space and being able to share gardens or resources or childcare or family care. Or I also bring up more and more, this is some of the case that I'm in, is just as a way to be able to afford a home. If you're a single income or lower two income family, there may not be houses in California that you can purchase on your own. So what are systems and tools that can help people feel empowered to buy properties together, save resources, both financial and otherwise, and also keep that from being a weird situation for them, how to make it successful for them?
We've talked a lot on the show about some of the challenges that people face when they transition out. And I'm wondering, since we have listeners across the spectrum, if you can share some of the most salient challenges that you've encountered, particularly in terms of housing for people post-release.
Man, that's a big question. Both the challenges in general and the housing specifically. And I think before answering any questions about incarceration and challenges of incarcerated people, I both want to say that my family member is my brother, And I just did the math. It's, and I think 28 years of the past 28 years, he's been incarcerated, 25 of those. He served a 5-year sentence when he was 19, got out, was on parole, and then went back to prison. And under three strikes and enhanced sentencing laws, was given a 52-year sentence without the possibility of parole. And in that time, he was almost always in prison in the secure housing unit of Pelican Bay, which is notorious for being the worst of the worst. And that's their line for the people they put there, but it actually is the kind of facility it was. But that's been my experience. A lot of it's specific to him and specific to the SHU. And I am a white lady who grew up mostly like lower middle class. And I've never been incarcerated. So I have been thinking about incarceration and carceral systems since I was 11 years old. I did my first, some of my first school papers were on the prison industrial complex. And I it's informed most of my life, emotionally, professionally, spiritually. And I just want to put that boundary on what my experience is, because most people who are incarcerated are not white and come from middle-class families.
Mm-hmm.
And again, also a lot of my experiences just with my brother, and there's lots of different types of incarceration for different people, and they're always changing. So
mm-hmm.
That said, I mean, when my brother first got out, if you don't have friends or family with resources, you certainly don't have them given to you when you get out. Oftentimes you barely have enough for a bus ticket. You get released, often very far away from the community that you came from. So, you know, maybe you're from San Diego, but you were imprisoned in Crescent City. You're now across the whole state, and they give you enough money to take public transportation home. But, you know, maybe you're lucky and you were incarcerated in the last 5 to 10 years, so you know how smartphones work. But if you weren't, you may be wondering where payphones are. Even just the journey to get home is its own radical trial, unless you have resources. So you kind of are released SOL, and then your access to housing and anything else depends on the connections that you have in your personal life. And again, even knowing there are growing programs and support for people who have been incarcerated, but you have to know that they're there and you have to have the resources to get there and to make those contacts. And that's just challenging out the gate.
What do you remember about your brother's experience when he was released after 5 years?
Yeah, I was just graduating high school. And I remember a real range of things. In retrospect, it is bananas to me that we did not get more help right away. So especially working in housing now, in emergency shelter and disaster recovery, I'm much more familiar with signs of trauma and stress and PTSD. We had no idea about any of that stuff at the time. And so I don't think we're able to really identify the signs. He had trouble. He had a lot of trouble with social cues and social spaces. He slept on the floor in our living room for a long time. When he first got out, he would brush his teeth over the toilet, just navigating, like the bed was too comfortable. So navigating a space at first was really alarming for him. And at the same time, we would stay up very late talking. He was very happy to have company, and we worked as servers together at Red Lobster. And I remember the joy that he brought to the work, the challenges of restaurant work that a lot of us take too seriously in our day-to-day jobs were just miracles for him. So he was able to take a real light touch to all that work. Those are my strongest memories.
You mentioned awareness that wasn't on board before, and we see more discussion about ACEs and trauma and trauma-informed care now than we did 10, 15 years ago. To what extent are affordable housing programs, in particular, aside from shelters, aware of and addressing the particular needs of folks who have been incarcerated?
This is the first time that I can remember in my life of really being asked about affordable housing and incarceration experiences. And I'm just noticing it's one of them started out as such a deeply personal and emotional experience, my brother's incarceration. Will just be like Niagara Falls at any moment. Mm-hmm. And I think I coped with that by learning a lot about systems and institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And then affordable housing is a realm that I approach from a very like systems and institutions mindset and went into change it and as my profession. So
mm-hmm.
I just noticed that blending the two of them, it's like two different sides of myself trying to meet to discuss. This is one area where I probably should know more. And I really don't. I know for affordable housing programs in general and emergency shelter programs in general,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
most, I don't know the exact number, but you're going to have a pretty high number of people that have been incarcerated at some point. They may not have been convicted of a felony, although I know a lot of them that have. But generally, housing insecurity is going to lead to some kind of incarceration of some form or another. So there's just, in general, a huge overlap between affordable housing programs and people who've experienced incarceration, because all of the issues that set someone on a course for needing housing assistance are the same issues that make someone vulnerable to being incarcerated. And I can certainly go into those if you want. There's a lot of them.
Sure, sure. An overview for listeners.
Yeah, I mean, one major one is the fact that in our state, it's less on the books now. But it doesn't mean it's not enforced that way, which is that just being homeless on its own can be cause for arrest. It makes you vulnerable to harassment. It makes you vulnerable to violence, and therefore makes you vulnerable to having to retaliate. It's very easy to pick up charges as a homeless person. You don't get a lot of protection from police as a homeless person. So also if you feel like your safety is threatened, and I'm saying homeless, but even if you're just housing insecure, moving from one place to another, you often have to take your own defense and safety into your own hands. Many people don't have the resources to cope with stress in ways like seeing a therapist or talking to their friends who are healthy and available people, or taking themselves out to a nice dinner. So they cope with stress with drugs that are often criminalized. They can't afford nice wines that other people get to enjoy on a day-to-day basis. So drugs is another big one, and people use them for lots of reasons. Either they just got addicted and now they don't know how to get off. And a lot of women who started using drugs when they became unhoused because they did not feel safe sleeping through the night. So drugs is another big one. Theft, vandalism, these are things it's very easy to be accused of, whether you've done them or not. And then again, it's just when we're made, housing is our key stability. And so when our housing is not stable, it's so easy for the rest of our lives to become just a mess, just a little avalanche of problems that allow it to be much easier to end up in situations where we are victims of bad choices, our own or other people's.
Mm-hmm. And we've certainly heard on our program too, both existing mental illness as well as mental health issues that come out of some of that lack of safety.
Yeah.
Being traumatized, lack of sleep, or physical illness that can manifest, yes, in terms of mental health.
Yeah. Both, I mean, homelessness and incarceration have that in common, which is that if you did not have mental health issues going into it, you certainly will after about 4 to 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. So your brother's experience of returning to prison, there are many families who have experienced that, that having their loved one home and things going okay, and then having them reincarcerated. What was that transition experience like for you, and what were you hearing from your brother?
Oh man, that experience, I don't think it's far enough in the past. He would not be upset about a public share. I think it's fair to say that experience was a nightmare for everyone. At that time, we still had in California, right? We have some new legislation, like you can't put a box on employment applications anymore in California. You have to check if you were a felon, but at the time you did. So that was one of his major issues, was finding employment. The employment he found, it's an industry, is very common for people to take methamphetamines to stay up and work all night. That put him in an environment that was unsafe and triggering for him. He makes awful decisions in that kind of environment. And once you've been incarcerated, it's so easy to become incarcerated again. There's for any number of reasons. So at that time I was no longer at home, but he was still living at my mom's house. I mean, that's another piece of housing, is like, if our family had not had the resources to both emotionally and financially to have space for him, to be able to put him up, I think he would have been in prison way sooner, back in prison. Mm. And I think that's an issue that a lot of people face. Where do you stay when you first get out? If your connections are all people that have the same issues that you do, that's not helpful. Sometimes our families are the ones that trigger that behavior in us. So if your family is the only option, maybe that's not a safe place for you or a supportive environment. Stressful on your family, it's stressful on you. That time was a nightmare. He also had already gotten off of parole. He served a 5-year sentence in the Pelican Bay SHU and gotten off parole. He was convicted again. And under California's three strikes laws and enhancement laws for something that would have been like a 7-year sentence, he got 52 years. You have 6 hours of your show to tell the whole story of what happened. So I can say, like, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare situation.
What is it like to strive to maintain contact and to be in touch with your brother? What are the challenges? We hear a lot about the costs of communication.
Yeah, and that is another recent change. Starting January 1st, 2023, California made a law that you can no longer charge for phone calls to inmates. The challenges of staying in touch. So starting at like 11 years old in the Santa Clara County Jail and moving to today, things have changed, communication has changed. But my general experience of my brother's incarceration is that the system is designed to interfere with regular human relationships at every turn. And at every turn, you feel like any kind of regular communication is disrupted. So anywhere from the phone calls that, for much of my experience of my brother's incarceration, you had to pay for quite a lot, really expensive phone calls, you know, every couple minutes you get interrupted by a 15, 20 second recording telling you that your conversation is being recorded. And at any moment, you know, your phone, you feel like your phone call could be disconnected. So you have to become very strategic with every conversation you have. And you start to learn that even if you're in the middle of an emotional conversation, you know, that lady is going to pipe in to remind you your conversation is being recorded, and she'll tell you when you've got 30 seconds remaining. So whatever deep share you wanted to have with this person, it's either a huge conflict in your life or a huge love of your life or a mix of both. Like, you better figure out how to wrap it up in 15 seconds. You also never know when those phone calls will be available or what's happening on the other side. In the time that my brother's been incarcerated, the only two family members that visited him were my mother and I, and my mom passed away in 2018. He's now married and he has a wife and family that have visited him. But especially when he was in Pelican Bay, for us, even from Chico, that was a 5-hour drive, Harry Drive up to Crescent City. All visits were behind glass with a phone, no contact. You would get an hour on Saturday and an hour on Sunday if you could swing it. And if you wore the wrong thing, if your coral pants leaned too much towards orange, or you had a wire in your bra, or the judge that your pants were too tight, or whatever the reason was, countless reasons, we saw them send people back, including
people who came to visit.
So that was its own stressful process, was getting ready. It was like getting the uniform down and learning to walk slow enough through the machines. And if you got sent back to change, then maybe now you only had 30 minutes to visit. Or maybe they would just suspend your visit altogether. So it made every visit just so high stakes. You had to do this 5-hour drive there, find a place to stay, make sure that you got every last piece of your clothing and appearance correctly so that you didn't miss out on those precious minutes, and then try to have a conversation with your loved one on a phone behind glass with both their arms and hands cuffed. And yeah, needless to say, that was a tough way to stay in touch. And we would see ladies at those visits who their husbands or their sons were there. They came up every weekend from like Los Angeles, from San Diego. So they would arrange buses for themselves. They would like share renting a van every weekend. They would go up. That's a 13-hour drive. So that's, I mean, for those women, that's their whole life, is being able to afford and manage the time to get up to Pelican Bay. So luckily, after the hunger strikes, the shoe at Pelican Bay was largely shut down. It's a whole other story.
Is that the solitary confinement?
Yeah, the secure housing unit. It's a big story, but not really your question. So, and I'll say the other piece is, after my mom passed and I had my personal needs to grieve, and we also, you know, we had the campfire in our region 4 days after my mom's funeral, and working in shelter and housing added some stress on top of stress. And I found myself needing to take some time from my family in order to grieve personally. And that also was really tough because it meant taking time away from my brother, which is time that I needed. However, I was his primary support, so I knew that time that I took for myself was really detrimental to him. So it was like, well, who do I want to harm, myself or him? Which is a rough choice.
And being that primary support, and it sounds like some of those women who were traveling 13 hours each week were in that situation as well. That seems to bring with it very heavy emotional labor burden and additional stresses that people might not think about. What don't people typically understand about what it takes to be that primary person for someone who's incarcerated for a long time?
Yeah, it does change when it's for a long time. And again, I can only speak from my own experience. And I think my brother's incarceration was one of the greatest financial and emotional taxes in our family's life. And I feel lucky that we had the relative privileged to be able to support that. So like if we had not had the funds to be able to make those drives to Pelican Bay, like that's a whole other story for how bad this is. Or if I had not been able to have the funds to have a therapist that I could talk to and process my emotions with so that I could offer support that was better, then who knows? What do people not know? I think just that often, and again, that's a policy that's supposed to be changing, is for people to be placed closer to where their family and community are. But for a long time, the policy was that you place people as far away from their family and community as you can, because it is all about punishment. That was the policy and practice of the California prison system, was what can we do that makes life as hard as possible on these people? And all it does is destroy their lives, whatever problems they had when they went in. They're certainly worse by the time they get out. And I don't think people understand how much of a toll it takes on the people that know them, because you don't feel like you're in there. That's a very different feeling. Being incarcerated, I can't imagine what that feels like. But for all of those years, I was never not thinking of my brother. I never wasn't aware that if I was on a hike or at a dinner party or doing something dumb, that he was sitting in a cement box. And not only him, but thousands, tens of thousands of people were doing that. And for all of what I consider pretty bullshit reasons. So yeah, that just toll of whatever you get to enjoy in your life, you know, it's being denied to lots of people, and in particular, someone that you know and you love. And it's weird to me that more people don't know that, because the stats I read recently are just, it's something like 40% of people in California will have an immediate family member who serves time. So the fact that we still think of this as like an isolated or a stigmatized experience is bananas to me. So many people are having to share it.
Yeah, when you mentioned the, you know, tens of thousands of people who are serving time, and then even if there is a primary person who's the main contact, still you can multiply each person by four or five other individuals who are impacted on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. It takes an emotional toll. Again, it takes a lot of time. Those visits take a lot of time. They take a lot of money. Spending time at hotels and out of the way places. Spending your money on, you know, at the time, the phone calls. So now phone calls are free, and we do have a tablet program for inmates. So they have access to a tablet for video calls. And then Canteen is the other one, where they make a crap ton of money in this industry. You get so little. And in the SHU, my brother's experience, I think he did a total of 14 years in the SHU. You didn't get salt. You didn't get, they were eating like 800 to 900 calories a day. They didn't get sweats. Like that was the result of the first hunger strike, was that they could have sweats in the winter in Crescent City. The only things they had to write with were the ballpoint pen cartridges, not even just the filler, or those like pencils like you used to get in first grade, the very fat pencils. No access to classes, limited access to books. So anything that was brought into their lives, and then the SHU was its own limited access to what you could send, but everywhere it's like, if you wanted additional stuff, that's going to be payment from your family too. So, and then I also, a lot of this experience came through just watching my mom, and for whatever else she did in her life, all the great work that she did, all the great relationships that she had, all the great love that she had for her community, this experience with my brother, she carried around like this weight on her neck At all times, at all times. And I think there's a lot of moms and wives and kids and sisters out there with that same feeling. And that, I don't know, there's a lot of material impacts and a lot of policy impacts, but that's the easiest one for me to think of is the fact that just we have this huge population of, in addition to, that's to say nothing of the trauma happening to the people who are incarcerated, but just everybody on the outside who is supporting that and seeing that, and you feel very helpless. You have no power. So it just weighs on you. It's like just a weight you have to carry around. And I'm like, what else would people be able to do if they didn't have to carry this weight all the time?
Not to mention what would it be like to have a more robust, more connected relationship with people.
Yes. I mean, that's for me, a big part too, and a big frustration is the truth is my brother was and can be a very difficult person. Some of that was really not his fault when he was a kid in school and was a quote unquote difficult kid. He had principals tell him that they were going to make sure that he'd never graduate. And that was a sort of writing off that we do of kids who are bad kids. And I feel like that's on the adults that were in those positions, but he certainly has made a lot of decisions in his life that were on him, caused a lot of harm to me and other people in my family. And that was a toll too, because I felt like, especially as a kid, was put in this position of had anger and I had hurt, and I wanted to be the one to be able to lash out at and punish my brother for how he made me feel. And I never got to access those feelings because he was under this much worse punishment. I could not entertain my own feelings because I could not leave him to be alone in that place. And I think there's a lot of people in that position too, where they end up having to support someone that they maybe have complicated feelings about, that maybe they have, just like in any other relationship, you know, I have a lot of love for him too, but sometimes anyone you've known closely for a long time, like you fight, you get angry. And that was another thing that's really hard is there's no room for those regular emotions and regular fights, and there's no room for reconciliation. It's very hard to stay in regular touch. It's very hard to, again, have those organic places to connect. You can only connect in one awful place. So that was another toll that I experienced, and that I think, a lot of people do, which is that you may be feeling a lot of hurt towards someone that you feel like you also have to protect.
Feeling like their needs have to come first.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well said.
So you mentioned therapy as a place that helps. And I know that you've been exploring other forms of support as time has gone on. What forms of support have been most helpful to you? What are you exploring and discovering that might help others?
Yeah, I have not found a lot of support that's been helpful. My experience with my brother's incarceration, his experience with his incarceration, I think has been and continues to be one of the hardest unsolved mysteries of my life. And honestly, the most support, the times where I feel like I'm okay, I could do this, have come actually from the work of organizations who are doing prison reform and abolition. So I guess I just, that would be, if I could make a wish about where more support comes in, that would be the top one, is policy reform. And ARC has been a big one, the Anti-Recidivism Coalition that started in LA, really trying to close that gap of getting people, even that very first step from when they get released to getting them to resources. And it's staffed by people who are formerly incarcerated themselves. So, and they've expanded their programs. They do legislative advocacy. I participated in the hearings on the shoe in Pelican Bay, and joining again all those moms and wives and sisters and kids, and a lot of men too, but it is predominantly women who are offering support. And we also do have a lot of women who are incarcerated, and it's predominantly women offering support to them too. Really grandma's keeping the world spinning right now. So yeah, participating in that hearing and having success and being heard was really supportive. Personally, I love my therapist. I don't know that she'll ever listen to this, but I don't want her to think this is a criticism of her. So she's been really helpful for my own feelings. However, I did find it hard to get help there because prison is its own. I felt like in the regular therapeutic landscape, I could say things that my brother had said or done to me, or things, behavior he'd had. Any good therapist is gonna be like, yeah, that's a toxic person. You should not have that person in your life. But you can't just say, yeah, that's a toxic person, I'm gonna cut them out of my life. Like, of course he's a toxic person. He spent almost 30 years in a maximum security men's prison. The
toxic place.
Yeah, that is a toxic place. Like, what options does he have? And I know that the greater harm is cutting him out of my life. So having to navigate those spaces where just the expectations you have for behavior and the understanding of trauma have to be so different. So therapy does help big time. And I think we just need a lot of help educating our therapists in incarceration issues, especially because there's so many of us, and making sure that that is accessible to more people, because it really is a privilege to be able to see a therapist still, even if you can get covered on Medi-Cal, finding someone in your area, especially areas like ours, like rural areas, really hard to find therapists who take Medi-Cal who are accepting new patients. But that does help. Shout out to my therapist, could not have made it without her. And then recently, and this is still bananas to me, because again, since I was 11 years old, you know, had a family dealing with this and talked to a lot of other people. It was just last year at the Angela Davis exhibit in the Oakland Museum with a dear friend. And a lot of her work has been on abolition of carceral systems. I just thought, wait a minute, I live in California. I don't live in the Bay anymore, but it's easy to visit. Here I am in Oakland, California. Half of our people in California are in prison, or whatever the number is. So we incarcerate a lot of people in California. This is the hardest thing in my life. There has got to be support for prisoner families. Like, again, this is the yay area. Like, somebody's got to have like a hyphy, wonderful organization around mutual aid and support and trauma healing. And I think those organizations are out there very small, but actually what I found is there isn't a lot of support. I did find the Prisoner Families Alliance, a wonderful organization originally started in New York City. And thanks to the pandemic, they do a lot of their work on Zoom now. So that is someplace I send people. But it seems like a lot of people don't know about it. And it's great. It is mutual support of families who have incarcerated loved ones. Their general meeting is nationwide. But even on that nationwide meeting, there were maybe 30 people on the call that I was part of. There's a specific meeting for West Coast, Alaska, Nevada, California. And there were maybe 6 people on that call. So I don't know where the gap is. I expected, I thought, man, I'm never going to be able to bring up this issue that I'm having. There's going to be 1,000 people on that California call. And there wasn't. I don't know why people don't access it more, but that they are there, and they have trained facilitators on each call, just a lot of experience from different families. And it was really healing. In like the General Assembly meeting I was in, there were people from Georgia and Rhode Island and all over the place. And I realized that there are people who are on day one or year one of this experience with their families. And so even though almost 30 years in, sometimes I feel like I still need support, it was also a tiny silver lining to be able to feel like, okay, well, at least I can put this experience to some use, supporting other people and making other people feel less alone. So that is where I would love to see more support too, is just growing those mutual aid spaces for families to offer some tough love and advice sometimes. And that's the other thing. I felt like in prison circles, there was not enough therapy for me. And in therapy circles, there was not enough prison for me. there's gotta be a middle ground.
What would that, in an ideal world where you live, that type of mutual aid organization, what would it look like?
I mean, that start, just these are all family members of people who are incarcerated, meeting up. There's some trained facilitators who have experience in incarceration and in nonviolent communication and in trauma and in facilitating groups. Just was a great setup for people to be able to share any number of logistical or relational issues. And that was helpful. So more of that. And again, in prison, they're the same, because getting the logistics right, which are impossible to navigate. Sometimes even if you have professional help, it's not good enough professional help. And you have to have a PhD in incarceration. And if you didn't when you started, you'll have it within a few years. But it's a nightmare to navigate all that stuff. And your loved one is on the line every step of the way. So just having some support from other people who know how emotional those decisions are for you and can offer a little bit of practical guidance, that helps. I think the Zoom format to some extent makes things a lot more accessible for people, especially when we're dealing with resources of time and money and gas and all that stuff. And probably having the option for in-person when it's safe and available is useful too. Just because any chance I think we have to make those regular human connections around prison systems is helpful. Because again, it really takes, like, every turn navigating the system takes a little piece of your humanity away. And I don't, just looking back on some of the things I said, I don't want to downplay the harm caused to people by some of the people who are in prison. This has always been difficult for me with my brother. Is when people hear he's doing 52 years, a lot of times the first questions they want to ask, like, if it's for drugs. And I know what they're looking is for a way to be like, is he innocent, is what they want to say. Like, is this a tragedy? And like, well, one, no, I don't think he had anything to do with the crime he was convicted of. He wasn't a perfect person. He did some violent things. He was the victim of some violent things. There's a lot of people who are incarcerated who caused harm. And this is where the tricky point is for me, again, is like, it doesn't justify the greater harm. As you said, like, oh, we have this, there's this harm being caused, sometimes just alleged harm, in a lot of cases, alleged harm. But even from when it actually is being caused, so we set up a whole system that can only cause more harm. And it's like, you have to choose. You never get to deal with the smaller harm because there's this like huge system coming down on people with only worse outcomes. So I guess I don't want to downplay the humanity and the agency and the real harm some people who are incarcerated have caused. And I want to make it very clear that there's no place in the system where that harm is reconciled, where justice is done, where there's healing, where we come out with less harm. We actually pretty much guarantee that whatever was wrong in the first place is going to be worse.
As you've learned more about systems and done a deep, got your PhD in this, have you seen any models that shift even in small ways that from the paradigm of punishment to something that's more healing or restorative or?
Yeah, a lot of what I, and again, I'm sure there's, I don't know how many people listen to this. I would love for you to get a bunch of calls and letters, people being like, that lady is wrong. There's so much out there. All these programs are happening. I would love to hear about them. I have seen some great changes in healing in my brother's time. Some of it, a lot of it has been prisoner led, in particular him. I mean, he's now, he's an elder in prison. He's 40, just turned 48 yesterday. Happy birthday. Those men who were in the SHU in Pelican Bay and other secure housing units carry a lot of sway to the general population. And they're old enough that, and this is the other thing about prison, is like, most of us stop effing up after 25, 30 years old. We just don't care about that stuff anymore. But because of how the system works, you don't really get the chance to age out. Like, you're probably already in prison a couple times by then, and the cycle has started. So for a lot of those older guys, they don't care about the stuff that the younger guys care about. They know what it's like to have seen their families die and not been able to be there, and they've got health issues, and they want to get degrees, and they want to be able to talk to women and or other men. Or so they've been real leaders in getting programming in there that can actually reach younger dudes. There's the Actors Gang project that my brother participated in. That work was amazing to watch. We got to watch their like a practice rehearsal for them. And they began by this group of probably was like 50 men in High Desert Prison who stood in a circle and did this exercise with this energetic gold thread that went between all of us and out in the universe. And they sat knee to knee and gazed at each other. And I was blown. I just started weeping because this is a society, a culture in there where you sit next to the wrong race and you have just started a fight. The amount of codes you have to follow and the violence that enforces them is like unthinkable to people who have not been around it. And then here they were, like knee to knee, all the, this is another thing I don't know everybody knows if they're not involved in prison, is that everything is divided by race and gangs. And if you didn't start in a gang when you went into prison, you're in a gang now that you're in prison. But all of those men were coming together for this project. I remember my brother sharing about getting the younger guys to wear makeup for this performance. It was incredible. So I think that it, allowing in what had been a very oppressive space, an unsafe place, them to access their agency, to create stuff, and also to access emotions on purpose. That's what theater is amazing for, is allowing us to bring up emotions that otherwise don't feel comfortable or safe. Have connection, more connections with the outside world. There have been some job trainings programs that have opened up. There's a podcast now coming out of San Quentin. And I mentioned all this stuff first because I feel like the most important and the most impactful stuff is all prisoner led. Like, that really, those are the experts. And although when I mentioned the Ear Hustle is the name of the podcast.
What is it?
It's called Ear Hustle. Mm-hmm. It's like the gossip. I remember my brother who was in High Desert had the same, it's like when you work up here in housing and you hear about cool stuff going on in the Bay Area, and you're like, of course they have that. They have all this money and all these nonprofits. And it was the same for him. It's like, of course San Quentin got a podcast. Like, there's a ton of money there. There's all these, got interns from Berkeley left and right just coming in to do cool stuff. So that stuff has been encouraging. I have friends who have worked in like book groups that go in and volunteer their time. Any program that creates that contact with people in the community that allows them to access other parts of themselves besides those survival parts. Which I feel like even, to be a creative person in prison, you have to be accessing your survival part all the time. There's never a part where you're not in that, in a pretty intense space. There's programs that increase access for family and especially kids to visit. This on the bus program where they do a whole bunch of programming for young people and help make sure those visits are possible. And also just getting more people out. I've seen shared recently a couple times this graphic. I think even some of our local elected representatives were the sign of why things are so bad. It shows the prison population in 1996 and how steeply it's declined since then. And the narrative is that there's all these people running amok on our streets. And I don't think people understand the context of that. That peak, that it's not that we've released people from a quote unquote healthy prison population. That peak that we're coming down from was when the federal government stepped in. Finally, when they were just like, holy hell, California, you cannot keep incarcerating people at this rate. That was when we were spending whatever it was, 4 or 6 times as much on prisons as we were on public education. We were stacking men up like in cafeterias and in libraries in prisons. They were just, you saw those pictures of just whole rec halls that had become dormitories, bunk beds, 4 dudes high. Just, you could not keep people sane or safe in that environment. And California was locking people up at a literally criminal rate. So that graph looks scary, I think, to people who don't know, because it feels like, oh, all these people have come out. But like, no, we were putting so many people in prison that we had to have federal oversight of what we were doing. And we were making things so much worse. So I feel like we're getting closer to, I mean, I don't think anybody should be in prison. We're nowhere near the rates that we were incarcerated people in the like 70s and 80s. Those were so much lower. So that's another thing that helps. It's just, can we get to a place where we have options besides incarceration in the first place?
And I'd like to end with asking you about what you do for your own self-care, and if that contributes to your feeling connected with your brother.
First, I did want to mention one more. That's local in Butte County. And a great mentor and community member and inspiration to me, Ron Reed. He was the president of our bar association and affordable housing developer and public defender. He was a developer in the Midwest, went into law as a public defender, felt like what his clients were facing in large part was a lack of housing and services. So went into affordable housing. And now he is working on a project called Project Upstream. Project Upstream is especially for juvenile offenders, like kids who get caught in the system. Ron's work with Project Upstream is to keep juvenile offenders connected to the communities they came from, so that even if we can't keep them from going to jail or prison, that there are lifelines that are maintained while they're gone. And again, it's really hard to have normal arcs of relationships with people who are incarcerated. You go long periods of time without seeing them. The way a lot of us keep up, right, is we like to share our news and our headlines, our big changes. But for people who are incarcerated, they often don't have big changes. If they're doing well, it's likely because they're paying really close attention to very subtle parts of their inner world and the inner workings of what's around them. And not a lot of us out here are good at knowing even where to start with that or listening to that. So I think accepting that this was a relationship I was going to keep having in my life and finding help with navigating that, like recognizing that it is heavy and that it's not something we can fix necessarily, because it's too big. Like the issues I may be having, my brother can't be responsible for those, and I can't be responsible for his. There's this huge system interfering with both. So getting the help to really like get to the truth about that. And then I think really tying personal experiences with incarceration and housing into my work, that's something you maybe have seen, certainly been a part of changing, is switching now in my middle age from seeing work as this thing I do for myself. I want it to be a good work. I want it to be right livelihood, but like a job is a thing you take off a shelf because it fits you, to understanding that we only have so much time in this world, and wanting what I spend my days doing to have the greatest impact in undoing this harm. So like basically getting enough of the sort of therapy and personal self-care, which I think is the same for me as a lot of people. Like I do Iyengar yoga, but some kind of spiritual discipline and body discipline generally helps people. I live in Butte County, so I spend as much time out with our beautiful creeks as possible. And when I can, get away to our traditional ecological knowledge classes and learn from the local Machuta about, you know, the land that I'm on, and connecting with nature, and learning to take my friends really seriously and keep up those relationships and lean on those relationships, and see a therapist regularly. So all that stuff has helped me. And I feel like supporting myself enough, setting those boundaries. Again, we're not good for my brother. They really left him hanging. But allowed me to reassess how I work in this world. I want to make a different impact. I want to look for ways that I can have a direct effect on this kind of harm.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for your generous sharing and for all you do in the community. You touched on a few things, but I know your service and your involvement and your outreach goes very far, and I am very grateful for all that you do. You've been listening to Bending the Arc, sponsored by Shasta Equal Justice Coalition. And the views we've been talking about are Lauren's and mine, and not those of the SCJC, KKRN, or Acorn Community Enterprises. And this is KKRN community sponsored radio, broadcasting from Round Mountain and Bella Vista, California, supported by listeners like you.